1320 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us this afternoon. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Lots to do on the program today. We're going to be talking a little bit about people over the age of 65 joining the labor force, and we're going to take a look inside People's Gas and some news going on there and a little bit about Wells Fargo. But before we do that, let's talk about YouTube. So there was a recent so-called purge of videos, and it was videos that were deemed to be, have shocking or dangerous or offensive content, and it involved removing videos, suspending users, all that kind of stuff. But that has created quite a stir. You know how people like to go to social media and voice their stuff? Well, indeed, this has created quite a stir. And so we're joined now by Drew Harwell, a reporter at Washington Post, who took a look at this move from YouTube. Hi, Drew. Thanks for being with us today.
Me.
Hi. There you go. I didn't have your phone call up for a second. There we go. So that's all right. Talk us through this a little bit, kind of the timeline of YouTube's move and user reaction and kind of where it stands now, if you would.
Yeah. So, I mean, YouTube is an incredibly important website. Obviously, most of America uses it. It sort of powers the videos that we run. And it's also become sort of an important news source. And, you know, a lot of people go to it. They follow people who may be sort of traditional media outlets or may just be people they want to hear from. And so, you know, it's this important kind of platform that people share. But in the last couple of years, the service has taken a more, involved look at, are we really putting out videos that we are okay with? Are we proud of sort of some of the stuff that's going out, or are we putting out stuff that may be offensive or may have violent stuff? And in the last couple of weeks, we saw one of the kind of worst examples of this, where after the Parkland shooting in Florida, there were some videos that were suggesting some of the students who had survived this shooting were crisis actors, and all sorts of videos sort of forwarding these conspiracy theories. So in the last couple months, YouTube has said, we're going to take a stand. We're going to hire thousands more content moderators to be looking at the videos that we host on our platform and making sure they're following our rules. But that's really hard for YouTube because they get about 400 hours of new videos uploaded every minute. And so it's almost practically impossible for any one person to look at all that stuff. But now that they're starting to crack down, more and more people are getting flagged, and more channels, including a lot of right-wing sort of pro-gun channels, are saying, whoa, this is unfair. You're pulling videos that aren't breaking the rules, that are just us sort of talking about issues, but aren't going against any policies, not shocking or crazy harassment or anything. So it's become kind of a face-off, and there's this big tension for YouTube in that they want to be responsible. They want to host, you know, good content that everybody can watch and appreciate, but they also want to be following the rules. And sometimes some of the uploaders and the viewers and producers are saying they're going too far.
And so this is really, it seems like it's kind of become this ideological issue more than about terms of service. But if we look at YouTube's terms of service, are the things that are being flagged and removed and users that are being suspended, are they directly and clearly violating YouTube's terms of service? Or is YouTube kind of stepping up and maybe changing their terms of service or reaching a little beyond them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, some of the videos that have been pulled, you sort of question whether they really did break the rules. I mean, there's one channel that does kind of historical military arms, guns and firearms and that sort of thing. And they posted some videos that were just, you know, shooting a rifle or blowing stuff up. It's, you know, it's kind of like crazy explosive stuff, but it doesn't seem to break any rules. And, you know, YouTube has kind of traditional rules that you'll see on Facebook or elsewhere that ban hate speech, they ban harassment or targeting people, that sort of thing. So when YouTube pulls videos, they're trying to get at those rule breakers. But these videos, you sort of wonder, are these really breaking the rules or not? And when we talked to YouTube, they said, you know, we're hiring a lot more people. They're looking at more videos. And so they're going to be flagging more content, maybe rightly or wrongly. And YouTube has even acknowledged, hey, we made a mistake in some of these occasions where they weren't really breaking the rules. A new moderator sort of came on and maybe didn't understand what they were looking at. Or, you know, and some of the stuff is kind of rides the middle. Some of it, you know, does start to get into, especially with some of the conspiracy theory videos, where maybe it does break a rule, maybe it doesn't. It's sort of hard to make a good judgment call on some of these. But, you know, I think it's going to be a really tough thing that YouTube is going to have to deal with. And it's something that really affects all of our lives because it goes to these issues of free speech and censorship and free expression. But there's also sort of a question of whether maybe YouTube does have the right set of rules, or maybe their rules are a little unclear and these moderators are just sort of trying to wing it when they can. But it's going to be difficult. I mean, when you're running a platform that suggest, you know, we're neutral, we want to support free speech in all ways, you start to run into these situations where maybe in some cases this is too much. Maybe we're going too far. And so that gets into the question of what do we feel like is an appropriate
right.
Level of content to be sharing on these things, and what goes too far.
And it seems like this very much mirrors a conversation that's been going on for a while on Twitter with, you know, mm-hmm. people constantly tagging the leadership of Twitter in their tweets saying, hey, when are you going to mm-hmm. do something about this? Clearly, this is hate speech. Clearly, this is, you know, crossing the line. So it is an interesting moment that we're in, I think. And did you get the sense in reporting this story that YouTube was going to maybe rethink their terms of service or expand them, or too soon to tell?
I think they will. I mean, I think they're running into so many episodes where they get egg on their face because either the policy is too open-ended, or the moderators are cracking down maybe too intensely. I think they're probably going, and like you said, I mean, Twitter is going through this too. Facebook is too. I mean, there was this big rush of democratized content in the first place where it was just like, let's just allow anybody to say anything. But now we're seeing, you know, when people get harassed or targeted, and, you know, in some of these Parkland kids, you know, they're being called out for all of these horrible things that they're mm-hmm. that they didn't actually do. You know, I think the platforms are starting to see, like, we have a responsibility here to be supporting good content and pushing back against stuff we don't want to host, because we have to remember these are the sites that give us this content. I mean, they are involved in promoting these ideas. So are they happy with the ideas they're promoting and putting out on their platform, or are they going to want to push back? So I think we're going to see more from them in this too.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting to consider the role of platforms that allow users to flag content, right? Because we can, if you mm-hmm. see a video and it's offensive or it seems like it's inappropriate, you can flag that video, and that kind of helps surface it to the moderators. Same with a tweet, same with a post on Facebook, things like that. Even on mm-hmm. on Instagram, you can do that. And I think that's interesting too, because again, there's that push-pull, I think, from the users of, you know, I don't know that all users are going to stop themselves and say, okay, is this just something I disagree with, or is this actually offensive and problematic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And we have to remember too that there are kids using these services. I mean, YouTube has a huge sort of kids section where they allow, you know, videos to be uploaded that suggest they have sort of their kids video. I mean, there's stuff with children's sort of content in mind, but anybody can upload anything. And we saw this in the last year where a lot of videos were being uploaded that were flagged for kids, audiences that were not appropriate and got into these really sort of icky, sometimes violent issues. So, yeah, I think the flagging from the viewer part is going to take a really big role in this, because there's no way right now for YouTube to be watching every single piece of content that they put on their website. So that's going to be really important. And, you know, I think it's going to be this conversation that we're going to be having as like users of YouTube and just people on the internet, where we have to ask, is this what we want, you know, our kids to see and just kids across the country and the world to see. So I think there's going to have to be clearer limits of what's right and what's wrong and what we're supporting on the internet.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's going to be some interesting conversations about digital citizenship and what that looks like and what that means. Well, we will keep mm-hmm. turning to you for more as that continues to unfold. Drew Harwell, reporter at Washington Post, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking a little bit about the rising number of people over the age 65 joining the labor force. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Still lots to do on the program. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about People's Gas and Wells Fargo, taking a look inside culture there and stuff going on there. But right now, we are joined by Carrie Hannon, New York Times columnist and editor and retirement expert, to talk about the rising number of people over the age of 65 joining the labor force. There's been some really interesting data about this age group that's come out recently we're going to take a look at. Carrie, hi. Thanks for being with us today.
Great to be here, Amy.
So there's some really interesting data around this trend right now that you've written about recently for the New York Times. And things that pop out right away is that more than half of American baby boomers plan to work past age 65 or not retire at all. That's according to a report by Transamerica Center for Retirement Studies. And the other is about how people over age 65 are, according to the Labor Bureau anyway, are kind of broken into two groups of people behavior-wise in the workplace. Talk with us about that, if you would.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Department of Labor has found that, you know, the two age groups, 65 to 74-year-olds, are really projected to have a very fast annual rate of growth, as are the 75 and older group. And, you know, it's really an interesting phenomenon. But, Amy, as you know, we're living longer, healthier lives. So this longevity is translating into people needing to work longer to support those extra years. And also, a lot of people simply have not saved adequately for a retirement that's going to be longer than one might have expected.
Right. And I think a lot of times when we're talking about big age group impacts on the workforce, a lot of the conversation lately has been around millennial workers and people just younger than millennial who are just now entering the workforce. I think we tend to put our attention there. But looking at these numbers, this is a really significant group of people that we should be talking with and talking about and considering. But it seems like in your reporting that perhaps there is a bit of a backlash or maybe some negative yardage or some feelings in the workplace culture to overcome.
Oh, absolutely. I think that employers have these old stereotypes that, you know, older workers are stuck in their ways or they're not up to, you know, have the stamina to do the job. They don't want to work well with younger bosses. They're too expensive. You know, there's all kinds of these things which, you know, they're not up to speed with technology. Any of this could be true for some workers, but it's certainly not the case across the board today.
And so as you were looking into this topic and as all this data has emerged, what are some, to counter those narratives, right? Maybe to counter those feelings in a workplace and the perhaps stereotypes for that group, what are benefits this age group is bringing to the workforce that we're seeing?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, we see an older worker brings experience. They bring loyalty. They're not going to be jumping around looking for that next job necessarily. So there's stability. Like when an employer, it's really expensive to hire people. So once you get somebody in the shop, you know, that's kind of a nice thing. So you have that ability to really harness this energy and the experience and the wisdom to get things done right now without the expense of training someone.
And so what could workplaces and members of leadership be doing to really make sure to convey in the workplace an anti-ageist stance and really make workers of all ages feel welcome there?
Yeah, I mean, there's some great ideas of things we can do. I personally think the most important thing is to have training programs that include the more experienced and the older workers. So it's not just designing training programs in the workplace for the younger workers. Keep everybody up to speed with tech, you know, with technology, the newest things in your field. That's the most important. But if you need to sort of segue out, phased retirement is a good idea as well because it gives the workers flexibility. And as we get older, that's what we want, autonomy in our jobs. And we want to step out of the workforce, not be pushed out of the workforce. So I think, you know, phased retirement is something to really, no one's going to do it as a policy for everyone. It's because it's expensive. So they're going to typically do it by choice, by employees. But get the conversation going. How could I work that out for me if I'm an older worker to make it possible? And I think, Amy, you should note, too, that as the workforce, you know, as the, you know, with unemployment the way it is today, the workforce is tighter. So, you know, employers are looking around and saying, hey, you know, maybe we do need these older workers because, you know, there is a demand right now.
Right. And did you find any companies that were particularly excelling in this area, really leaning into workforce, having a workforce of, you know, a wide swath of ages, but particularly working towards attracting older workers.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so great. There's some good things happening. This was made me so happy to write a piece that finally looks at a positive story about aging. And so there are some companies. There's a company that the shipbuilding company, Huntington Ingalls, has apprentice programs that are good for older workers. And, you know, we've got an accounting firm in New York. New York actually did an interesting thing where they have Age Smart Awards, where they actually, you know, look for Age Smart employers and they attract companies who are, you know, entering this contest. And so there's a variety of businesses from accounting firms to manufacturers of springs. So, you know, really look into your communities and check these things out. But even Steelcase, the big furniture maker, has some really interesting phased retirement programs.
It's a really, really interesting topic. I think, as you point out, we're living a lot longer. But I think also we've done a pretty good job, I think, of changing our thinking around this, where I think some people are kind of like, you know what, I don't have to retire if I don't want to. I can keep going. I want to keep going. I say that as someone from a long line of people who did not want to retire and kept working a long time. I think there's a feeling of, I think it used to be the case that everybody knew when you were 65, you retire. And I think we've rethought that so much that now I think that it's a little more open for people to kind of do as they please in many different stages, not just, not necessarily just working out of financial necessity, but sometimes out of, you know, activity and wanting to stay engaged in the workforce.
That is so true, Amy. It is. The thing about work is when you know, often when people retire, they go into almost a depression because they lose their sense of identity. When you have work, even if it's part-time work, you know, it's really, studies show, it's good for your health. It's good for your mental health because it's use it or lose it, and it's good for your health in general because you're socializing, you're out, you're relevant, you have a reason to get up in the morning. There's all kinds of great benefits that of staying active and staying involved intellectually and physically in the world. And so I really find it's a really great phenomenon that people are recognizing the importance of work. And I always say, you know, work is not a four-letter word.
Indeed. Indeed. Carrie Hannon, New York Times columnist, editor, and retirement expert. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right. We are going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Still lots to do on the program. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about Wells Fargo. We have talked about that company many times and some of their challenges in recent years. So we're going to take a look and see what the latest is going on over there. But right now, we are joined by Steve Daniels, senior reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, who wrote about People's Gas and their plan to continue replacing gas pipes in Chicago. And there are many, many issues surrounding that project. Welcome to the program, Steve Daniels.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Certainly. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with us. So talk us through this a little bit, because it seems like a pretty straightforward project, but indeed it has started to, as we're starting to see numbers attached to it, it has become a bit contentious.
Yeah, it's nobody. First of all, nobody disputes that there are aging natural gas pipes made of materials that are leak prone that need to be replaced. So, and this is happening in cities all across the United States. The issue that arises with this program, which is an accelerated pipe replacement program, meaning they wanted to do more replacement more quickly. Which started about 6-7 years ago, has just been the cost and the expense of it and what that is already doing to natural gas rates. And, you know, that's how people heat their homes and what it will, more importantly, what it will do in the next 3 or 4 years unless there are some changes. And so far, the people who are responsible for overseeing this haven't been inclined to make any changes, despite a lot of evidence that the cost of this is out of hand.
So when we're looking at these numbers, what is the range we're talking and how much overage?
So, yeah, I mean, the project started out back in 2011 or so as what people estimated to be a $2.5 billion project over 20 years. Since then, the estimated cost of the life, you know, of the project over its lifetime has ballooned to over $8 billion. Some estimates put it at $10 billion. And it's a longer time frame than 20 years. It's people's aims to have it all done by 2040 at this stage. So all of that has meant that the cost of it is far more than it was anticipated to be when the state legislature gave people the ability to charge people every month an extra amount on their bills to help finance this project.
And then there's the other issue attached to this, and that is under current management, people's the work being done is being done more expensively than under the previous leadership team.
Right, and that's a big issue because everybody who's involved in this, regulators, the company itself, consumer advocates, everybody agrees that the previous management team handled this horribly. There was an independent audit done of the program. It was harshly critical and basically said there were no cost controls whatsoever. I mean, the cost management was not really something that was a priority at all. So it is very alarming to see the current management, which said, hey, we're better than these guys. We're going to solve these problems, come in and produce. And the way you sort of figure this is cost. How much does it cost to replace a mile of pipe? So on that very basic metric, they've actually performed more poorly than the previous management. They're doing this work more expensively than the utility in New York City is doing its work. I mean, it's only a little bit more expensively, but there's no excuse for that. I mean, there's going to be no place on earth where it's going to be more expensive to do this kind of work than New York City. And again, it just doesn't seem to be much of a response from the Illinois Commerce Commission, which is the state body that regulates utilities, or frankly, even from the mayor of City of Chicago. I've been a little surprised at that myself. Mm-hmm. The city has certainly raised alarm bells among lower level folks who have been participated in this, but it just hasn't gotten to that point. And, you know, it really is a ticking time bomb for low income Chicagoans who increasingly can't afford to heat their homes right now.
Right, right. And so are there efforts being done? Are there lawmakers or any kind of groups forming to try to reach a solution here to both pay for this, but also be fair to consumers in terms of cost?
Yes. Finally, there are some efforts along those lines. The person who is really, I think, deserves the most credit for raising the alarms on this, and she's been doing it for years now, is Lisa Madigan, the state's attorney general. So consumer advocates have gotten state rep Will Gazzardi, represents Northwest Side neighborhood in Chicago, to introduce a bill that effectively would take away this ability of people's to charge people every month an extra amount on their bills to pay for this program. And, you know, he just introduced it. I think he's got one co-sponsor. It really remains to be seen whether that goes anywhere or not, but it's got the full push and a very strong push from consumer advocates on this who are sort of tweeting about it constantly and trying to raise public awareness. I think it's too early to figure out whether that's going anywhere or not.
So under the legislation that Gazzardi has proposed, where does that cost then move to?
Well, then peoples would have to, if they wanted to continue spending this amount, we're talking about, this is unprecedented capital spending, just to give people an idea. We're talking about $500 million capital spending budgets. That is this program and then other capital projects, roughly speaking. That's basically double what Peoples historically has done, even in the priciest years. I mean, it's really something. So what it would do is it would force Peoples to go through the regular regulatory process to get rate hikes approved. And that's a far more onerous, exhaustive process than simply being able to automatically pass through these charges, which they're able to do under the state law, and then basically have regulators do an after-the-fact check. And, you know, if they find that some of these expenses are out of hand or in the lexicon of the utility regulators, imprudently incurred, they can force them to refund some of that. But that is not the way to do this. It's very onerous, difficult legal standards to be met. And so, yeah, effectively what it would do is just put them back into the regular order which involves much more scrutiny.
Right, right. So as we're looking at just the scope of this, it seems like quite a messy sort of deal. What is the next thing we should be looking for in this unfolding story?
Well, I think the next thing we should be looking for is the whatever happens to that bill in Springfield. So, you know, that's over the next few months. Other than that, if that goes nowhere, then, you know, I just imagine that they're going to take another run at it. I really think the regulators at the Illinois Commerce Commission have made it clear that they think they have effectively no authority under the law to force Peoples to lower its budget, which is a very dubious legal proposition, but nonetheless, if that's what they think, that's what they think. So that means that all roads to solving this problem run through Springfield, and you know, then the legislature has to come in and do something about it. I think the other thing to look for is maybe some increased involvement by the mayor, since the man seems to be running for re-election, mm-hmm. and this will be one hairy issue for him in another term if that's what comes to pass. So those would be the two things I'd look for.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we will keep turning to you for the latest on this. It is a really interesting topic. And if you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this story out. But you can, if you don't want to wait until the end of the show, you can go to chicagobusiness.com, find the story, and read it for yourself. There's a lot of really interesting data in there. Steve Daniels, senior reporter at Crane Chicago Business, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to take a look at the latest inside Wells Fargo and how they are trying to recover from that big scandal a couple years ago. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. You know, we have discussed Wells Fargo many times in this program. About a year and a half-ish ago, you know, they had a big scandal with the bogus accounts that were being created, and there's been much conversation since about its recovery process. And here to talk with us about the latest is Laura Keller, Wall Street reporter at Bloomberg. Hi, Laura. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
So talk us through the latest here, because when all of this hit, it seemed like, you know, because this huge scandal with so many bogus accounts being created to meet these quotas had originated inside the company, it just seemed unrecoverable. I think so many people just thought, how in the world will Wells Fargo ever have public trust back?
Right. And as we see, you know, 18 months later, you know, they still are struggling with that. I think that's something that the bank has had difficulty rebuilding. They talk about rebuilding trust, but that's an issue that they are continuing to move forward on. As you said, you know, this really started with these sales targets that executives had imposed on those branch bankers for many, many years. And that was all to get at this cross-selling metric. You know, the bank wanted to give as many products as it could to each household in America. So once that, you know, was brought to light and regulators really came down hard on the bank for that, you didn't see these executives being able to wrap up that scandal. It just got bigger. And we had additional problems that were disclosed as well in other consumer businesses. So, you know, last summer we found out that the bank had been imposing this car insurance, certain kinds of car insurance, two different types, on customers who had auto loans. And then also there was a scandal on people who were taking out mortgages because the bank was charging people for what they call a rate lock to get whatever rate that was promised to a person to continue to have that rate after a long period of time on a loan application. So there's really been a couple of different things here. And then also the executive's inability to really figure out how to get the reputational risk out of the way.
Right, right. And so one interesting thing many interesting things that you note in the piece at Bloomberg, but one of them is that there was immediately, after this scandal, there was a vision and values booklet, kind of like an internal document talking about their mission statement and that kind of thing, that initially, after the scandal, talked about rebuilding trust as one of its priorities, and that has since been removed. How do you interpret that move?
Well, I'll let Tim Sloan explain that first, and then you can sort of look at that. Basically, what he's saying is, you know, yes, indeed, the bank did put this rebuilding trust priority onto that sort of corporate visions and values booklet statement. But eventually, he wanted to make that more concise. He felt the document was too wieldy, and he wanted basically his employees to be able to figure it out a little bit more easily. So he pulled that off. But in terms of, you know, it being a priority that the company has stated, I mean, it's not there anymore in that corporate vision and values statement.
Which, you know, I think that kind of opens them up to a, well, wait a minute, I thought you were trying to, you know, rebuild here. What are the steps that you see? You know, I think we can watch a leader talk about, hey, we're trying to rebuild, we're trying to reestablish trust, but I think it really comes down to action. And what are the actions we're really seeing from Wells Fargo right now?
Right, and that's something that the company, you know, obviously wants to talk about because they want to be able to show that they have taken steps to clean up things, you know, take that responsibility. So they have shuffled around some senior managers in the C-suite. I mean, Tim Sloan himself only came to the job after the former CEO, John Stumpf, left the bank, you know, under heavy pressure from politicians and others as well. So that's been done, but you haven't really seen a lot of departures of really key executives. You have seen some in some of the different retail businesses and the consumer businesses, but most of those are really mid-level people. I guess if you look at the board as well, you know, there has been a shift there, certainly. There's been a lot of people who've gone. Even just this week, they announced that four more people, including three of the longest-serving board members who've been there for more than a decade each, they will be leaving. But still, I mean, there's still a lot of room for criticism there because even if you take the board for an example, five members of the board of directors, including the chairman, are still there. And those are people who had been there from when the sales scandal was happening. You know, people who could have stopped it from happening or should have maybe known that it was happening. Five people on the board will still remain even after all the board changes. So there are still a lot of politicians and others who are criticizing the bank saying, look, you haven't really pulled out all of these people that we think were problematic. And to be fair to the bank, I mean, that's really hard. I mean, if you think about going back to the sales scandal, 5,000 low-level employees were fired, you know, for basically cheating on these targets, making up these false accounts. So if you look at that, 5,000 people fired, I mean, that's a very large percentage of the bank. Even if they have, you know, 200,000-plus employees, that's a lot of managers as well who had supervised these people.
Right. And did you get the sense that there have been some significant changes to the culture that led to that in the first place? In particular, are those same kind of quotas still in place for branch managers and people that, you know, ultimately were fired for this kind of behavior, like trying to meet these quotas? Has that shifted? Are there stopgaps or anything like that that they're talking about?
Right. And that's another thing that the bank very much likes to highlight. They have pretty much immediately after the scandal happened, they eliminated the sales goals that were really driving a lot of this. So that has been taken care of. And now instead of focusing on number of accounts, they focus more on overall growth, you know, team members working together and customer satisfaction. So that piece of it has been addressed in the bank's mind. But in terms of culture, you know, a lot of people are splitting those two things up. They're not considering those sales incentives, those goals, to be part of the culture of the company necessarily. I mean, Tim Sloan himself really is saying, look, we don't have a culture problem. The thing that was problematic was that incentive plan, and we've done away with that. Now, there are people, though, who say, well, look, it's pretty hard for us to see how it wasn't a culture problem, that incentive wasn't part of that as well, when cross-selling was just so defined the bank for so many decades. So I think there's still a lot of critiques happening around there. You know, Tim Sloan, who's been at the bank for more than 30 years, doesn't feel like the culture of the bank is a problem. But I think many people who look at it from the outside feel like it is a culture problem. It's beyond just a sales target problem.
And in terms of how Wells Fargo is interacting with the Federal Reserve and other government entities right now, how has that shifted after this scandal?
Right, because you did have the Federal Reserve come in last month, you know, with this, what they called an unprecedented sanction against the bank, which is that they can't grow any further than they had been in terms of assets at the end of last year. Now, that is a big hurdle for a bank because they're constantly growing. That's what they need to do in order to continue to increase profit. For the most part, it's one of the easier ways. So having that in position now, Tim Sloan is under a lot of pressure because he basically has to choose his spots. He has to say, well, here's a place where I'm comfortable, you know, maybe letting a few customers go. They've outlined certain types of clients, more in the corporate bank, that they're willing to do that on. They want to continue to take deposits from consumers. They want to have consumers still banking with the bank. But he's in a tough spot because he really does have to pick that. So in terms of, you know, the Federal Reserve, they have a lot of things. The bank has a lot of things that it's going to have to do in order to appease the Federal Reserve and get that cap lifted. But there are other regulators as well. You know, we don't know necessarily the tenor of their internal conversations, but the bank has disclosed that it remains under investigation by three federal authorities, including the Department of Justice. So those are, you know, they're still looking through the bank, still investigating. And this week we also learned that the SEC, one of my Bloomberg News colleagues reported, is looking into wealth management as well at Wells Fargo. So that's your brokerages, that's your wealth advisors, your financial advisors. That's being probed too. So the bank could have another very large scandal on its hands, and regulators, you know, will be looking at those things beyond the things that they are continuing to look at. Just to want to mention too, you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the OCC, you know, they're likely still looking at the auto lending and the mortgage rate locks scandals that I talked about earlier, because there haven't actually been sanctions on the bank for either of those two consumer issues.
Right, right. So much to this, and apparently
so much
more ahead, I'm sure. So we will continue to turn to you at Bloomberg for the latest as it continues to unfold. Laura Keller, Wall Street reporter at Bloomberg, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit on 720 WGN.